My name is Robert Bruce, and I'm a financial journalist. Welcome to this regular podcast of the latest IASB FASB board meeting. With me to discuss the meeting held between the 15th and the 18th of February are board member Steve Cooper and Alan Teixeira, Director of Technical Activities with the IASB. And we are delighted to be joined for the first part of the podcast by Sir David Tweedy, Chairman of the IASB. Sir David, how did the board meeting go?
I think it was one of our best meetings. It was highly successful. The boards work extremely well when they're together. I think it's so much easier doing it in person than by video conference. Both boards agree with that. It's not just the chemistry, but it's easier to deal with things, and you can shuffle papers about. And we went very well. We're dealing with some pretty tough issues, trying to finish off this memorandum of understanding. Revenue recognition, we got some very good feedback on that, which we were working on. I think the decisions were made this week. Industry would like them. We think they're sensible too. We like them as well. Leases, again, we looked at the issues that had been raised on the exposure draft, and we understood the problems that people may have had with what was proposed before. Again, we've made decisions that will deal with many of these issues. Insurance, it's a huge project, been running for about 15 years off and on with our predecessor body and ourselves. And this morning when we discussed it, I really felt we made massive progress. More than any other meeting I think we've had, both boards trying to come to solutions, both boards willing to move from different positions. It was highly successful. Now, I think we must say that with FASB and the IASB, this was one of our best.
And there are a whole range of major convergence projects which are approaching completion in the coming months. How are they looking?
Well, these are the projects that we have been discussing. They're coming on well. The G20, especially at the time of the crisis, more or less said you've got to try and finish these by mid-year. One or two of them, which weren't so critical, that have slipped out, and everyone agrees they weren't the big ones, but these are the big ones that we're working on just now. There have been areas of controversy in accounting for years and years, and we've been working on them for years. And while it looks like we're sprinting at the finish, it's really a sort of long marathon where we're coming to the end of, and that's when we look at the time that's been involved in it, staff, board, comment letters coming in, being analysed, people attending round tables, hundreds of people around the world, organisations being visited. It's all just coming to an end at the moment. We're going to do some more outreach. I mean, one of the things that we have to do is test the solutions. We've got the comments in the from the exposure drafts. Now we look at these comments, many of them we fully agree with. We just want to make sure we've got it right. So we will be going out to people who wrote in to us to say, you had this problem, we think we've solved it, do you think we've solved it? So a lot of that's going on at the same time. So the next few months are really finishing this off, having several meetings like this. We're now in touch with each other in meetings twice a month and the odd days in between. So you know, the second meeting has to be on video because we can't obviously get together that often. We'll go to FASB next month and they'll come here for the next 3 or 4 months to finish this thing. So we're on track. Our target is to finish these projects by June. There's a lot of countries changing to IFRS in 2011-2012. They don't have to change twice, so they're pretty keen we do finish. Clearly, if we can't quite get there, we won't publish rubbish, so we will have to sort of delay the publication date, but that's by no means something we're thinking about now. We think we can do it with FASB, and FASB are certainly pitching in to help us get there. So, you know, I think we've got a good chance, and the staff have been terrific. They've worked very, very hard, both sides, FASB and ourselves, and the board members have too. So I think there's a good collaborative air about the projects. We've gone through a lot of issues this meeting, and I think we're on target.
Sir David Tweedy, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Hello, my name is Robert Bruce, and I'm a financial journalist. Welcome to this regular podcast of the latest IASB FASB board meeting. With me to discuss the meeting held between the 15th and the 18th of February are board member Steve Cooper and Alan Teixeira, Director of Technical Activities with the IASB. and we are delighted to be joined for the first part of the podcast by Sir David Tweedie, Chairman of the ISB. Sir David, how did the board meeting go?
I think it was one of our best meetings. It was highly successful. The boards work extremely well when they're together. I think it's so much easier doing it in person than by video conference. Both boards agree with that. It's not just the chemistry, but it's easier to deal with things, and you can shuffle papers about. And we went very well. We're dealing with some pretty tough issues, trying to finish off this memorandum of understanding. Revenue recognition, we got some very good feedback on that, which we were working on. I think the decisions were made this week. Industry would like them. We think they're sensible too. We like them as well. Leases, again, we looked at the issues that had been raised on the exposure draft, and we understood the problems that people may have had with what was proposed before. Again, we've made decisions that will deal with many of these issues. Insurance, it's a huge project, been running for about 15 years off and on with our predecessor body and ourselves. And this morning when we discussed it, I really felt we made massive progress. More than any other meeting I think we've had, both boards trying to come to solutions, both boards willing to move from different positions. It was highly successful. Now, I think we must say that with FASB and the ISB, this was one of our best.
And there are a whole range of major convergence projects which are approaching completion in the coming months. How are they looking?
Well, these are the projects that we have been discussing. They're coming on well. The G20, especially at the time of the crisis, more or less said you've got to try and finish these by mid-year. One or two of them, which weren't so critical, that they've slipped out, and everyone agrees they weren't the big ones, but these are the big ones that we're working on just now. There have been areas of controversy in accounting for years and years, and we've been working on them for years. And while it looks like we're sprinting at the finish, it's really a sort of long marathon where we're coming to the end of, and that's when we look at the time that's been involved in it, staff, board, comment letters coming in, being analysed, people attending round tables, hundreds of people around the world, organisations being visited. It's all just coming to an end at the moment. We're going to do some more outreach. I mean, one of the things that we have to do is test the solutions. We've got the comments in the from the exposure drafts. Now we look at these comments, many of them we fully agree with. We just want to make sure we've got it right. So we will be going out to people who wrote in to us to say, you had this problem, we think we've solved it, do you think we've solved it? So a lot of that's going on at the same time. So the next few months are really finishing this off, having several meetings like this. We're now in touch with each other in meetings twice a month and the odd days in between. So you know, the second meeting has to be on video because we can't obviously get together that often. We'll go to FASB next month and they'll come here for the next 3 or 4 months to finish this thing. So we're on track. Our target is to finish these projects by June. There's a lot of countries changing to IFRS in 2011, 2012. They don't have to change twice, so they're pretty keen we do finish. Clearly, if we can't quite get there, we won't publish rubbish, so we will have to sort of delay the publication date, but that's by no means something we're thinking about now. We think we can do it with FASB, and FASB are certainly pitching in to help us get there. So, you know, I think we've got a good chance, and the staff have been terrific. They've worked very, very hard, both sides, FASB and ourselves, and the board members have too. So I think there's a good collaborative air about the projects. We've gone through a lot of issues this meeting, and I think we're on target.
Sir David Tweedie, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Okay, now let's look at some of the details of what was discussed in the meeting. Steve, do you want to talk us through what was discussed on insurance?
Thanks, Robert. We had quite a few sessions on insurance, and The insurance team actually have done a separate podcast, I believe, for this meeting. So perhaps it's not really worth my while going through a lot of the detail. We covered a number of different areas, including risk margin, discounting, unbundling, many of these were sort of either taking tentative decisions or doing educational sessions. The one key area perhaps that it is worth me highlighting in this is the discount rate issue. We spent quite some time talking about this. It's been a real live issue during the comment period, a lot of outreach on it and a lot of feedback from different people. And of course, I think I've said this before in these podcasts, a wide range of views. We've taken a decision that we shouldn't use an asset rate, that it's not appropriate to use the rate on a linked portfolio of assets, the underlying assets, to discount a liability, that the rate should be one that relates to the liability, is appropriate for that liability irrespective of the assets held. In the exposure draft, we looked at, we said that it should be a risk-free rate plus an illiquidity premium. Feedback on that was that it's quite difficult to calculate that illiquidity premium, and many suggested that we should do more of a top-down approach. Now, top-down doesn't mean necessarily asset rate, because, of course, you can start with the return on the assets and then remove the amount which relates to the risks and the expected credit losses in order to get to a rate which would be close to, not necessarily the same as the rate that was in the exposure draft. So we said that it should be a rate specific to the liability. We have effectively decided that we're going to allow different approaches to determining that, either a bottom-up approach or a top-down approach. Top-down approach, removing the expected credit losses and the credit risk. That might leave in something in addition to the illiquidity premium, but that's fine. It's getting to a rate which is appropriate for the liability. We also discussed briefly practical expedience. Some people have said that because of the difficulty of determining this type of rate, one approach would be to look at practical expedience in, for example, a high-quality borrowing rate. Didn't make any firm decisions on that, but this will be something that the staff will bring back and do some more analysis on. So other than that, as I said, there's we looked at a number of other different areas, made good progress on those things. Particularly, we had a very good discussion on risk margins and the composite margin and risk adjustments. And no firm decisions, but certainly a lot for the staff to take away, giving them good direction on how we might proceed. You'll recall that the FASB and the IASB had different views on this issue. The IASB favouring a separate risk adjustment, the FASB favouring a composite margin. So we're exploring ways in which we might reach an approach that that included aspects of both, essentially. So that was very positive, and I think good things for the staff to go away and think more about.
Good. Okay, let's move on to revenue recognition. Alan, how did that go?
It went very well. I think we had three separate sessions across two different days. It's one about when you're dealing with something for 6 or 7 hours at a time, it's good to split. Quite a few decisions made this month and made really good progress, I think. And of course, each of these decisions, what we've started to do now is that as we firm up the decisions and get the drafting done and our modifications, we're going to go back out and do a little bit of field work on this to make sure that we're addressing some of the issues that came up in the comment letters and not creating new issues as a consequence. One of the things we did have a look at was separating, identifying separate performance obligations, and so that if you're providing perhaps a bundled up lot of goods and services, when should you separate them, when should you treat them as one thing? And basically, you count a bundle. One of the criteria was really is if the entity itself provides a service of integrating those goods or services, then you should treat those as being a single one. And interestingly, one of the examples that sort of popped up after that meeting was somebody sells, you've got people who sell cars, they also sell spare parts to the cars. Does that mean you have to unbundle it because they also sell spare parts? And of course, one of the things they do is they're selling a bundled thing, and so you keep that together. You need to account for something separately if you find that the pattern of transfer of the good or services, if they're different. So if you've got a different delivery of one thing compared to the other, you should treat those as being separate. Or if the good or service has a distinct function. And then, of course, people say, well, what's a distinct function? Essentially, the board agreed there were two characteristics or features. One is that the entity regularly sells the good or service separately. So you can imagine that things like handsets or something like that, if you're selling those handsets separately or bundling them up as part of another contract, that shows that there's potentially a distinct function. And in the discussion itself, we talked about some perhaps types of, I'll call it an asset, but it was so ancillary, it doesn't work by itself. The only reason you had to give this thing, and perhaps if you go back to the old cable TV days, didn't work, have any of the much use by itself, but it was there to facilitate getting the service. So you'd bundle those things up as opposed to something like a handset that you can either buy a chip for yourself or you can buy it in conjunction with a service. Or else the customer can use the good or service on their own. In other words, it's got its own unique functionality that is helpful to the customer. And those decisions were supported unanimous for across the boards. We also had a look at revenue recognition for services. They had been having discussions in January and basically decided to recognise revenue for a service. The entity has to determine that the performance obligation is satisfied continuously. And then it's got to select a method of measuring progress towards completion. And of course, that's always going to be a bit difficult and requires judgment, and we've got to just make sure we provide enough guidance, I think, for that. The types of things that people talk about are when you've got example that's come up is you build a ship and then you drop the engines in, for example, or you build a power station and the last thing you do is put the generators in. Is cost input a sort of thing the appropriate basis for allocating the revenue, or should you look at some other basis there? So we're trying to make sure we do get sensible solutions. To have a look at that, so they've got the criteria for that, and that in terms of satisfying a performance obligation continually, you have a look at things like the entity's performance creates or enhances an asset that the customer controls. So you imagine something as simple as I'm having a roof put on my house, and so as it's being performed, my roof's getting more and more complete. That's something that I control, and that's where you look at recognising it continuously. The other way is sometimes they doesn't create an asset, but the customer receives the benefit, or else the entity wouldn't have to re-perform the task, for example. And the simple case for that is, let's say that I have a package I want delivered around the world and it's actually made it 3/4 of the way around. They use another company to do it. The rest of it, you should be entitled to recognise the revenue for the bits that you did perform. And again, they were unanimously supported by the boards. We looked at another couple of issues. Obviously, there was quite a lengthy discussion, but combining contracts. Most of that was about wording, but it's pretty clear sometimes where there's no way that you'd enter into two contracts, perhaps entered into the contemplation of each other. You wouldn't price one up without having the other one associated with it. If that's the case, you have to treat that as one contract. But of course, sometimes we'll unbundle that afterwards anyway, so you'll end up separating those components. We looked at contract modifications, definition of a performance obligation. Perhaps two things that I'll just focus on now, breakage and prepayments. Because when you hear breakage, it's not about, I broke something after I bought it, but it's about breaking the contract.
Yes.
And perhaps the easiest thing to think about in some ways, and this is actually kind of like breakage in a way, I might buy lots of cheap airline tickets in advance. I know people who go to Europe might buy a whole lot of discount airline tickets, don't turn up one day. In a sense, they haven't turned up, they've broken the contract in a way. And how do you deal with that? Things like gift cards. And what they've decided is that you should actually look and recognise over the period that the performance is taking place. And so if the history shows that people, when they've got gift cards, will spend £9 out of £10 and then the rest is sort of lost or in draws or never used, then every time they spend a pound, you'd recognise the £1.10, which would be the extra bit that you know is just not going to be redeemed otherwise. And onerous performance obligations. Sometimes people go out with sort of a loss-leading component of this. They're willing to lose a bit of money on one part of a contract because they're making margins on the other. And the tentative decision there is that they're going to look at, we look at the contract as being what we call our unit of account. So just because you have a loss on one part of it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to recognise losses up front for that. You have the unit of account is the contract as a whole. We've got a bit of work to do on that, though, and we're going to continue that debate in March.
Excellent. Now, the third big issue for this week's board meeting was leasing. Steve, how do we progress on leasing, which has been a complicated field with a lot of criticism from the outside, or a lot of comments from the outside.
It has been complicated, and there has been a lot of comments. We were tackling some of the areas that were particularly controversial this time, so definition of a lease term, contingent rentals. Made some good progress. Lease term, I think we largely resolved. Definition of lease and contingent rentals, we're going to be doing some targeted outreach on some of the not decisions, but the alternatives that the boards were considering, so that we can get a little bit more feedback on some alternatives and we can then take a decision. And we also discussed an area which is lessee accounting and the accounting treatment in the income statement for the lessee and a possible way of resolving some of the other issues that have arisen. So if I start off with lease term, the exposure draft suggested that optional lease period should be taken into account in calculating the right of use asset and the liability based upon a maximum lease period more likely than not to occur. A lot of people criticise this on the basis that such optional periods are just that, they're optional, and therefore how can they actually represent a liability at the balance sheet date? And what the board has done is to effectively go back to contractual lease term, but to amend that and take into account optional lease periods where the lease is structured in such a way to give a clear economic incentive to extend. So, for example, if there's a primary lease period and then a secondary lease period, an optional period where there is a very low rental, then clearly there's an economic incentive to continue leasing for the full period of the lease. Or alternatively, perhaps you can cancel a lease, but you have to pay a very high penalty in order to do that cancellation. Yeah. Then there's a clear economic incentive to lease for the longer period. And in that situation, we would say, well, the real in-substance term of the lease includes that optional lease period. But other than in those situations, we've gone back to the contractual lease term. In terms of contingent rentals, the exposure draft viewed this as a measurement issue and saying, well, if you have a contingent rental in a lease agreement, then you should forecast what those contingent rentals will be. It becomes a measurement issue and include that in the liability based upon that forecast. Many people said, well, that's all very well, but how on earth do you forecast out, for example, contingent rents based upon sales revenue when you've got a 20-year lease or something, and clearly a very difficult process. Also, you're effectively increasing a liability, a lease liability, a financial liability, for something which is more like a variable operating expense, and many people criticized it on that basis. We haven't taken a final decision on this. We had a long discussion. I think we did say that if contingent rates are based upon an index, so interest rates, for example, then they should be included. But those contingent rentals which are based upon activity or revenue, there was a tentative decision to focus upon what would be probable or reasonably certain. I think people were concerned that if these payments were reasonably certain, we wanted to get something in. But this was an area where we struggled in terms of exactly what we wanted to do in terms of adding in some additional amounts. And there were a number of ideas that were floated. So the staff are going to do some targeted outreach on this particular issue to identify what the practical problems might be and what the constituents that were particularly concerned about this in the comment letter process, what they think of it. So they'll be contacting those people over the next few days. We also looked at the definition of a lease. This is of greater importance under the model that we're developing because as we're putting more leases on balance sheet. And we made some good progress on this in terms of what is a specified asset, the right to control. Although we're sticking largely with existing GAP, we do recognise that there is an important need to clarify. So I won't go through the detail of it. People can read it in update. One of the examples, though, is if an asset is incidental to the provision of a service, don't start hunting out the assets in various contracts and putting them down as leases. If it's really just incidental to the delivery of a service, then treat the whole contract as a service contract. So that's an example of where I think we're trying to be pragmatic about really what the definition of a lease is. Last issue is two types of lease from a lessee's perspective. In the ED, we just had, from a lessee perspective, a right-of-use asset, whether it was a long-term lease, short-term lease, right-of-use asset and a liability, and we accounted for these leases in the same way. So the liability would be repaid and interest accrued, asset would be depreciated, just as you would at the moment for finance leases. Many people argued that the profit and loss profile that you get from that is not reflective of the underlying economics, you know, because you end up with the front-end loading of that expense. And many people argued that really the true economics of a lease, particularly the shorter-term leases, the more operating, if I can use that word, lease, is more like straight-line a straight-line expense matching the rental payments that are made. So we were looking at perhaps a way of accommodating that and thinking of how we might develop the model further. Actually, it's not really developing the model. It's partly going back to what we have, which is straight-line recognition for yep. operating leases. So we were exploring the possibility of doing what we have in the ED as far as the balance sheet is concerned, recognising an asset and a liability, but modifying the basis on which we amortise that asset to give an answer in the income statement, which is closer to existing GAAP. So it's sort of a combination of the ED and where we are at the moment. So we discussed that, and there seemed to be quite a lot of support for at least doing some further investigation of that particular issue and whether that's something that would work. And so, again, some element of targeted outreach in that particular area by the staff. But we made good progress on those four really important issues, and I think we'll be in a very good position next month to take some decisions in those, or to finalise decisions in those areas.
Excellent. Let's tie up the loose ends. What else was discussed, and what should people be looking out for in the coming weeks? Alan?
Right. Well, I guess the three other little projects I'll just mention. People will probably be aware that we published a supplement in relation to impairment that is of financial assets. We published a supplement to the November 2009 ED a few weeks ago. And even though that's out for comment, there are quite a few issues in the ED that we still have... are not in the supplement, so we're starting to discuss those, and a couple related to disclosure, that relate write-off policies and stress testing, etc. So again, if you have a look at update, you'll see the decisions made there. They just simplify some of the disclosure requirements a little bit. Consolidations and joint arrangements. The last little bit we had there was to sort out the effective dates. The reason we've been held up a bit was that we have a much wider request for views on effective dates and transition methods, and we wanted to make sure that we had the comments in there, and we've actually got comment letters are in, and we've analysed all of the comment letters, been through to get a general sense of what people have said, as well as looking at every specific comment related to consoles, JVs, etc. And it's pretty clear the support, I think, for us to basically go ahead with these separately from the leases, RevRec and insurance projects. So we basically agreed that the effective date for all of those would be 1 January 2013, with early adoption permitted, and then you know, we've got the update will describe the transitional provisions. The one thing is we're a little bit, because we're coming right through reporting season, in the Northern Hemisphere in particular, and people are concerned that they'll have to comply with ISA, which describes the effect of the standards that haven't yet applied. We'll put a publication plan on our website so people know when the earliest date that these will be coming out, so that they don't get caught by this. But yep. that's not likely to be, the actual publication won't likely to be till early March. The last thing we did is we also wrapped up all the debates on post-employment benefits. We looked at effective date transition disclosure. Probably the most substantive issue was presentation of remeasurements. We exposed this, the remeasurements were to go into OCI. The board decided back in December to allow remeasurements into the profit or loss. Then in January, they had a look to see whether they should put some restrictions on that and identified a couple, such as it could be plan by plan, but it had to be irrevocable. Staff had a look at that, and there were perhaps some unintended consequences, and they asked the boards to have another look at that decision. The staff were ready to go and do more work on that if they wanted to keep restrictions and perhaps even a look at shaping some more constraints around that. In the end, the board, in a very narrow vote, it was only 8-7, have gone back to basically OCI. So that's probably the biggest decision for them. And that means that you probably towards the end of March, we expect to publish the amendments to IAS 19 on, so that's dealing with defined benefit schemes. At the same time, we'll get the amendments to IAS 1, that's our financial statement presentation, dealing with some changes to how to present other comprehensive income. So it'll be a fairly busy time coming up, I think, for publications. Then people can just keep an eye on the website for that. And also for meetings. We meet again, this is mainly a virtual meeting, again with the FASB on the 1st and 2nd of March. I think both meetings start at something like 1 p.m. GMT. So, and they'll probably be about 3 hours each of those afternoons. And then again, the week of the 14th of March is a full week of meetings for us here in London, but the FASB will join us for much of that. But they'll be in Norwalk, so we'll have two sites running on that. And the week after that, the 21st, we'll be travelling to Norwalk for a joint meeting for the first 3 days of the week. And then I think there's an insurance working group on the Thursday after that. So if March is going to be very big for us. Really, it's going to break the back, we think, of the re-deliberation issues on the major projects. And we've got a lot of meeting time to make sure we can cope with that.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Steve Cooper, Alan Tashiro. And finally, the traditional disclaimer, this podcast reflects the personal views of the participants and does not necessarily represent the official views of the IASB. For the official detail, go on to the IASB website.